This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Race or other types of struggles, you raise the question of how working class or workers' struggles intersect with the broader struggle that we have as human beings against rapacious capitalism that's destroying the earth. Could you tell us a little bit about how your background brings you to being so concerned with this intersection?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my background is as a blue-collar kid who grew up in an industrial working-class family and was around unions and union activities from a very, very early age, not in a sort of formal or active sense, but just as really just as sort of a condition of the community, right? And over the years became very much involved in environmental activism and environmental politics, and found that there was a troubling disconnect between my own experiences and the concerns of family members and friends that I lived with and that I knew growing up, who had deep concerns about the environment.
And some of the things that they were actually doing sort of underground, if you will, to address some of their concerns in terms of dealing with harmful substances in the plant and aspects of production that they didn't like, and they were dealing with in a direct action fashion in terms of sabotage and things like that. And the perspectives that were dominating some of the environmental groups that I was involved in, and at that time I was active with Greenpeace at a pivotal point in Greenpeace's development, when they were shifting from being a direct action oriented group towards one that was geared largely towards lobbying, relying on low-paid canvassers to fund their lobbying campaigns, and Earth First, which had emerged largely in response to that shift in Greenpeace and was taking a much more explicitly direct action approach, and which was really shifting the perspective on nature away from one of resources towards one that was integral in its own right. So what I was finding was that within the environmental movements, there was a real hostility towards working people, particularly towards industrial workers, based on a whole range of assumptions that weren't particularly well informed, and which were in many ways superficial and biased. And at the same time, I was working at that time for Greenpeace as a canvasser in a context where the organization had moved away from direct action. We used to have direct action trainings every week. We were involved in direct actions on a regular basis in nuclear-free seas campaigns, where we went and targeted warships, in campaigns against clear-cut logging, campaigns around dioxins and contaminants in the Fraser River at the time in Vancouver. And the organization had moved away from that and was reconstructed on the basis of canvassers out to raise money, right? Not to be concerned about talking about direct action or doing education work, and more being put in precarious positions where canvassers who didn't raise enough money, didn't meet a financial quota, were faced with reprimands and, in troublingly large numbers, faced with firing. Right? So I was part of a group within Greenpeace that was trying to recognize those intersections, the fact that we're being exploited at work as canvassers, but more broadly that in the industries that we were dealing with, that we were organizing around, that there was a dual exploitation going on there too, which was the exploitation of labor and of the people that worked in those industries, and the fact that they had very little decision-making or say or control within their workplaces, and at the same time that the environment was being exploited for profit. And how do we hook up with the people who are in those industries who don't necessarily like the conditions of their work, don't like the way things are happening, and certainly don't like the fact of their own working conditions and their own exploitation, yet they have knowledge about what's going on. They can be helpful in terms of organizing campaigns and so forth. And so that was sort of the starting point around trying to bring people together around that intersection of exploitation.
So this is a book of theory, of history, of kind of a primer on organizing tactics. You focus on the post-Marxist theories of Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe. What is kind of the theoretical stake as far as green syndicalism is concerned?
Well, for me, it's not even so much the theoretical stake. I think that really that probably we'd need a longer conversation in terms of, you know, what I'm talking about in green syndicalism, and some of the main emphases and what it's pitched at. And in terms of green syndicalism, it's on the one hand it is a sort of a theoretical perspective, a way of understanding intersections of exploitation and issues of the destruction of nature, the destruction of planetary life, including the lives of working people who are being exploited in industry, but trying to draw those connections in a way that focuses on alternatives, right? Alternative ways of organizing, alternative ways of thinking about production, about thinking about our lives and the role of our lives in producing for our needs as humans, our community needs, and so forth. On the other hand, it's really directed at rethinking how we organize, how we, as people who are concerned about issues of ecological destruction, threats to the biosphere, and as people who are concerned about the fact that our bodies and minds, our lives, our families, our communities are being worn down by exploitative labor, how we can organize on a real basis to challenge that. And I think it speaks to getting away from activism as something that is sort of external, that is done on a kind of a lobbying basis or on a moralistic basis or on a
professional basis
and how we root that in our day-to-day lives and experiences, how we root that in communities, how we root that in our workplaces. And on the one hand, I've spoken about this in different contexts and touched on it a bit already, that activists who may go to work and may complain about their job and may complain about the fact that they'd love to escape work and, you know, get away from that and how it's not part of their identity or whatever, then fail to recognize that, well, you spend a great deal of your life in a workplace, you're being exploited, you're a worker, right? So they'll come to an action, or they'll be involved in a demonstration or something, and they'll put all of their moral force into whatever that issue or concern is. And then if you say, well, we don't have much power standing here on the streets expressing our moral outrage, but maybe if we were dealing with the exploitation that we've experienced all day before we came here, we might have some real power. And then having the response be, well, yeah, but I'm not a worker, right? You know, well, why not, right? You're spending a good deal of your time working for somebody else. You're being exploited. Your labor, the value that you're producing in your labor is being stripped off of you. Why don't you view yourself that way? And maybe if you did, maybe if you had the conversations at your workplace, you'd find that there are a whole bunch of activities going on there that are directly related to the issues that you're concerned about, whether they be environmental issues or issues of another sort, that you could address in a real meaningful way if you started to, you know, do some organizing, maybe exert some power, collective power, with your fellow workers in that workplace So it's part of reorientation that way. It's also one to say that we need to, if we are in a workplace where we have some organization, perhaps a union, that we need to think past that structure as well. That we need to not necessarily look to organizing within a formal union framework, that is, run for positions within the union, become a vice president or something like that, but that the real organizing work that needs to be done is the work of organizing with our fellow workers on a rank and file basis.
So this is why
building some kind of oppositional strength even within unionized structures. And that gets into a whole discussion about the bureaucratization of unions and the turn towards management of the contract as primary union function rather than issues of workers' democracy, workers' control, and so forth.
So what you're saying is that workers need to have a more revolutionary perspective towards what unionism means.
Well, even a reorientation towards what organizing means within the workplace itself, right? That what a union is, what is a union?
A union is a collection of workers coming together for mutual aid.
Exactly. So that means that typically we've built up a lot of resources through years of doing that, but we don't necessarily have control over or access to those resources, and those resources are used in ways that don't necessarily address the real issues that we might have. So on the one hand, we've got these resources, how can we use them? But on the other hand, our real strength is always going to be that coming together collectively in solidarity for mutual aid for our fellow workers, right? And so rank and file organizing, and some of the things I talk about in the book, things like flying squads, right, as ways to respond to issues in a fairly rapid way, in a way that puts direct action at the forefront, in which members are making decisions about how to go forward, how to proceed, how to take action, and committees, right? So I talk about anti-poverty committees, anti-racism committees, and so forth, that get past this sort of false divide that has built up in unions when unions have become largely committed to managing a contract and view their responsibility as collective bargaining, negotiating a contract, and then policing the articles of the contract, that a separation builds up between the workers, and this speaks to intersectionality again, between workers who have real lives in the community, right, who live in specific neighborhoods, who are involved in specific groups in the community, but then suddenly when they go to work, the door is closed on that. Right? And the unions oftentimes close the door on that because they view their purpose as dealing with the contract, right, and the articles of the contract. So in the committees that I talk about, these are experiences, you know, real-world experiences that I've been directly involved in where there's an attempt to break those barriers down, to get past that divide. So to take what are working class resources that have been built up by working people over years through their collective organizing, even within the structure of a mainstream union, and making those community resources.
I got to cut you off, Jeff, because that is all the time we have for today. And if you go to the website when this is posted, you can find an extended conversation that Jeff and I had surrounding the issue of green syndicalism and his organizing experience. I've been talking with Jeff Shantz, author of Green Syndicalism and Alternative Red-Green Vision. Jeff is a professor of criminology up at Kwantlen Polytechnic University in British Columbia. Thank you for joining us, Jeff.
Great, thanks very much. I'm glad I had the chance to speak with you. Thanks.
The canals and the bridges, the embankments and cuts, they blasted and dug with their sweat and their guts. The shanty towns rang with their songs and their fights. Navigator, navigator, rise up and
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am your host and engineer, Joe Clement. We just heard a track from the Pogues' wonderful album, Rum Sodomy and the Lash, called Navigator. And before that, I was talking with Jeff Shantz, author of a book called Green Syndicalism. I mentioned that you will be able to hear a much more extended conversation that we had when the episode in the whole show is posted on the Old Mole's webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, up next, Bill Resnick is going to be having an interview as well with a book author named Robert Dietz. Robert Dietz is the author of a book called Enough is Enough, and they discuss the potential for a stable state economy and really thinking through transforming the world from being profit-driven to need-based principles.
Rob Dietz, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Rob Dietz directed the Center for the Steady State Economy. He and Dan O'Neill wrote the book Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. He's now the editor of the Daily News, D-A-L-Y. The chapters of Rob Dietz's book include Enough Inequality, Enough Unemployment, Enough Business as Usual, Enough Materialism. The book appears to me an attack on the fundamental thrust of today's economic systems, that is, the necessity of exponential growth that characterizes capitalism. The book is also a critique of a secular religion with billions of followers, Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and many more, It's the religion of consumption as the way to the good life and the sign of grace and maybe a source of salvation and eternal life even. Rob Dietz, why did you write the book first, and what would you replace the current system with?
I wrote this book, honestly, because I was in a bit of a state of malaise. You know, if you go out there and you ask people, do you think we're headed in the right direction when it comes to the environment and the economy, hardly anyone feels like we are. And so that says we need a change. It's not like it's just a feeling. It's based on the evidence. We're seeing the effect of having grown the economy too large for the ecosystems that contain it. Those effects show up in the form of depleted water resources, species extinctions, too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the climate change that's resulting. All of these kinds of environmental problems are growing more and more urgent by the day. And at the same time, if you look on the social side, you can see that we are continuing to grow the economy, continuing to add income, but it's not making us any happier. So the whole notion to me was that we need to figure out a different way to run things economically. And so, you know, the second part of your question, what would we replace it with? Simply, we would replace the economy that's always chasing after more, you know, more income, more jobs, more stuff, more consumption, with an economy that recognizes the wisdom of enough. You know, think about what it would feel like to have enough jobs, enough income, and enough consumption.
And, of course, income that's distributed, and that's one of your chapters, distributed in a way so that everybody has enough. We're growing income, of course, but it's all going to the top for the most wasteful and destructive consumption, whereas ordinary people are getting more insecure and often poorer.
That's right. If you look at the media, you see the most stunning statistics. I was reading an article just this morning, and I saw that the top hedge fund manager in 2012 earned over $1 million an hour, you know, which is as much as the average American family makes in 21 years. So it's mind-boggling how we've gotten to this huge gap between the rich and the poor in America. Yeah, that's a part of the story of how the economy needs to change. If we are going to limit the flow of materials and energy through the economy to a sustainable level, you know, to a level that doesn't undermine our life support systems, to a level that allows us to meet our needs while future generations have the opportunity to meet their needs, well, then we better think about how we distribute the resources. And, you know, having a Wall Street manager make the same amount in 1 hour that takes 21 years for an American family to make, that's just absurd.
That's not to mention the differences in wealth. Most families are in the hole, and some people own the planet. I mean, a good portion of it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, another silly stat, you can think of the heirs of the Walmart fortune. You know, the six people that inherited money from the founders of Walmart, they've got as much wealth as 150 million Americans. The control over the resources is in the hands of the few, and that's harmful to our democracy. That's, in fact, entirely anti-democratic.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Rob Dietz, who, with Dan O'Neill, wrote the book Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. One very important thing that your book does, and I know intentionally, is to point out to people and begin making the argument that the system could change, that we really now know enough. Some issues remain, and there's all kinds of development. But the Earth could, in fact, support the kind of a population we have now if we radically change the way we produce and consume and live together. Tell us about that.
You know, the idea is that our current economy is aiming for perpetual growth. And that's not possible on a finite planet, and it's not desirable either. So the idea here is, instead of aiming for perpetual growth, we'll aim for sustainable and equitable well-being. So in order to do that, that means we're going to have to change from a growth-obsessed economy to one that looks to the concept of enough. And so what that means is we've got to figure out how to change the policies and institutions so that they work under those circumstances. You know, right now, if the economy stops growing, certainly the politicians panic because that often leads to job losses. So, you know, the idea is in a stable economy or a steady state economy, we'd be looking at how do we have jobs available so that work that needs to be done can be done and people who need a job can get one. That's really what we do in the book. We talk about the set of changes that needs to happen. And so, you know, one of them in the jobs front is to look at making things more flexible. The idea is work time reduction, meaning there's a lot of people out there who actually are earning high enough incomes that they would willingly trade some of that income for more time. By doing so, that would open up job opportunities for people who are unemployed or underemployed. So basically, it's about sharing the work. And another possibility along those lines is guaranteed jobs. We've got a great example in U.S. history with the Civilian Conservation Corps of providing jobs for people who needed them and providing skills for those people that they could use for their lifetime. And we got the side benefit of doing incredible public works, you know, building some of our most beautiful infrastructure and restoring ecological systems. That's just one area, jobs, where by changing how we structure our job markets, we can have more of a sustainable economy that doesn't have to grow.
You also talk about the different forms of agriculture, different energy systems. All of them are now technologically possible and, in fact, more productive and, in fact, for agriculture, restore the fertility of the land. Do you talk about that?
A little bit. You know, with agriculture, with energy systems, the idea is to localize, to get away from these overly large polluting systems where power gets concentrated at the top, and to look at systems that can be run by communities where they understand the output and manage any of the pollution, manage any of the consequences, rather than just externalizing the cost on the general public. So any kinds of systems like those are certainly commensurate with a steady state economy.
Let's talk about just ways of life. We only have a couple minutes. Are people ready to give up? And it's not everybody. A lot of people, in fact, need more. They need better food. They need decent housing. Around the world, most people are still pretty poor. How do you get the people at the top? And not just the top. There's a middle class that is consuming way out of proportion to their need and for the what the planet can carry. Are they going to give up their lifestyle of taking planes to Disneyland frequently?
In some ways, I don't think it's a giving up. I think it's a transition to something better. And that's what's hopeful for me, is that we seem to be waking up. We're waking up to the fact that happiness doesn't come from more and more stuff. It doesn't come from, you know, increasing our wealth. Sure, we all need enough wealth and income to meet our basic needs and maybe provide a few comforts, but real happiness comes from things like connecting with our friends and our family and our communities. It comes from being active, from being mindful, living in the moment, from continuing to learn. So the beauty is that they don't really cost us anything. And we can do them, we can achieve the sense of well-being, a sense of a good life, you know, without burning through so much of planet's resources. So that's really the whole idea, is that we can make this transition. It's not like a bunch of sacrifice. It's actually an awakening and a transition to a better life.
And with lots of satisfactions, actually. Rob Dietz, we're going to have to end the interview, but let's talk again. You've raised so many issues, especially issues of political issues and how we get there and what the possibilities are of building that contending force that we talked about earlier, not on the air, that's going to be necessary to ultimately lead the way when people begin realizing that the system just has to be changed and radically changed. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, and we'll have a second half of the interview within the next 2 or 3 weeks.
All right. Thanks, Bill, and happy Earth Day to your listeners.
All right,
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, brought to you live from planet Earth. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm your host, Joe Clement. We just heard a track from the Cowboy Bebop soundtrack, What Planet Is This? And before that, we heard Bill Resnick talking with Rob Dietz, co-author of a great little book called Enough is Enough. Well, the next two pieces that we are going to bring you somewhat go together, so make sure to try and listen to them together. First, Tom Becker is going to be reading an excerpt from a piece, which is itself an excerpt from a book David Graeber has just published called The Democracy Project. The excerpt is called The Practical Utopian's Guide to the Coming Collapse. He talks about developing a planetary imagination about the kind of strategies and revolutionary demands that we need to start making. And after that, I will be bringing you a commentary about why we should be giving food stamps to everyone. So coming up next is Tom.
Good morning. Today, in recognition of Earth Day, I'm going to share with you a short piece by David Graeber entitled Work It Out, Slow It Down, which itself is excerpted from a longer article which appeared in the Baffler magazine, The Practical Utopian's Guide to the Coming Collapse. Graeber argues that the planet cannot long survive under the current regime of unfettered capitalism with its mantra of constant growth. Normally, when you challenge the conventional wisdom that the current economic and political system is the only possible one, Graeber begins, the first reaction you are likely to get is a demand for a detailed architectural blueprint of how an alternative system might work, down to the nature of its financial instruments, energy supplies, and policies of sewer maintenance. Next, you are likely to be asked for a detailed program of how the system will be brought into existence. Historically, this is ridiculous. When has social change ever happened according to someone's blueprint? It's not as if a small circle of visionaries in Renaissance Florence, conceived of something they called capitalism, figured out the details of how the stock exchange and factories would someday work, and then put in place a program to bring their visions into reality. In fact, the idea is so absurd we might well ask ourselves how it ever occurred to us to imagine that this is how change happens to begin. This is not to say that there's anything wrong with utopian visions, or even blueprints. They just need to be kept in their place. The theorist Michael Albert has worked out a detailed plan for how a modern economy would run without money on a democratic, participatory basis. I think this is an important achievement, not because I think that exact model could ever be instituted in exactly the form in which he describes it, but because it makes it impossible to say that such a thing is inconceivable. Still, such models can only be thought experiments. We cannot really conceive of the problems that will arise when we start trying to build a free society. The most obvious is technology. This is the reason it's so absurd to imagine activists in Renaissance Italy coming up with a model for a stock exchange and factories. What happened was based on all sorts of technologies that they couldn't have anticipated, but which in part only emerged because society began to move in the direction that it did. This might explain, for instance, why so many of the more compelling visions of an anarchist society have been produced by science fiction writers. In fiction, you are the least admitting the technological aspect is guesswork. Myself, I am less interested in deciding what sort of economic system we should have in a free society than creating the means by which people can make such decisions for themselves. What might a revolution in common sense actually look like? I don't know, but I can think of any number of pieces of conventional wisdom that surely need challenging if we are to create any sort of viable free society. I've already explored one, the nature of money and debt, in some detail in a recent book. I have even suggested a debt jubilee, a general cancellation, in part just to bring home that money is really just a human product, a set of promises that by its nature can always be renegotiated. Labor similarly should be renegotiated. Submitting oneself to labor discipline, supervision control, even the self-control of the ambitious self-employed, does not make one a better person. In most really important ways, it probably makes one worse. To undergo it is a misfortune that at best is sometimes necessary. It is only when we reject the idea that such labor is virtuous in itself that we can start to ask, what is virtuous about labor? To which the answer is obvious. Labor is virtuous if it helps others. A renegotiated definition of productivity would make it easier to reimagine the very nature of what work is, since, among other things, it will mean that technological development will be directed less toward creating even more consumer products and ever more disciplined labor, and more toward eliminating those forms of labor entirely. What would remain is the kind of work only human beings will ever be able to do, Those forms of caring and helping labor that are at the very center of the crisis that brought about Occupy Wall Street to begin with. What would happen if we stopped acting as if the primordial form of work is laboring at a production line, or a wheat field, or an iron foundry, or even in an office cubicle, and instead started from a mother, a teacher, or a caregiver, who might be forced to conclude that the real business of human life is not contributing towards something called the economy, a concept that didn't even exist 300 years ago, but the fact that we are all, and have always been, projects of mutual creation. At the moment, probably the most pressing need is simply to slow down the engine of productivity. This might seem a strange thing to say. Our knee-jerk reaction to every crisis is to assume the solution is for everyone to work even more. Though, of course, this kind of reaction is really precisely the problem. But if you consider the overall state of the world, the conclusion becomes obvious. We seem to be facing two insoluble problems. On the one hand, we have witnessed an endless series of global debt crises, which have grown only more and more severe since the 70s, to the point where the overall burden of debt, sovereign, municipal, corporate, personal, is obviously unsustainable. On the other, we have an ecological crisis, a galloping process of climate change that is threatening to throw the entire planet into drought, floods, chaos, starvation, and war. The two might seem unrelated, but ultimately they are the same. What is debt, after all, but the promise of future productivity? Saying that global debt levels keep rising is simply another way of saying that, as a collectivity, human beings are promising each other to produce an even greater volume of goods and services in the future than they are creating now. But even current levels are clearly unsustainable. They are precisely what's destroying the planet at an ever-increasing pace. Even those running the system are reluctantly beginning to conclude that some kind of mass debt cancellation, some kind of jubilee, is inevitable. The real political struggle is going to be over the form that it takes. Well, isn't the obvious thing to address both problems simultaneously? Why not a planetary debt cancellation, as broad as practically possible, followed by a mass reduction in working hours, a four-hour day, perhaps, or a guaranteed five-month vacation? This might not only save the planet, but also, since it's not like everyone would just be sitting around in their newfound hours of freedom, begin to change our basic conceptions of what value-creating labor might actually be. The morality of debt and the morality of work are the most powerful ideological weapons in the hands of those running the current system. That's why they cling to them even as they are effectively destroying everything else. It is also why debt cancellation would make the perfect revolutionary demand. All this might still seem very distant. At the moment, the planet might seem poised for a series of unprecedented catastrophes than for the kind of broad moral and political transformation that would open the way to such a world. But if we're going to have any chance of heading off those catastrophes, we're going to have to change our accustomed ways of thinking. The human imagination stubbornly refuses to die, and the moment any significant number of people simultaneously shake off the shackles that have been placed on that collective imagination, even our most deeply inculcated assumptions about what is and is not politically possible have been known to crumble overnight. That was a piece by David Graeber entitled Work It Out, Slow It Down. David Graeber is a contributing editor of Baffler magazine and the author of Debt, The First 5,000 Years. His new book is Democracy Project. This article is excerpted from that latter book.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. If you just tuned in, we had heard a reading by Tom Becker of an essay by David Graeber titled The Practical Utopian's Guide to the Coming Collapse. Somewhat as a companion piece to this, I am going to read an essay by Matt Breunig, which he published on his blog, mattbreunig.com, called Just Give Everybody Food Stamps. Matt offers both qualitative and quantitative arguments for why we should just give everyone food stamps. And after I read the piece, I offer some of my own comments on the political significance of giving food stamps to everyone. The right wing is getting riled up about food stamps again. Sean Hannity even dedicated an entire hour to the food stamp program, with predictable messaging about how it is exploding and a scourge on the country. While the purpose of this manufactured outrage is to get rid of or dramatically shrink the food stamp program, I think a better move is to go in the opposite direction and just give everyone food stamps. Before we get into that, some facts might be helpful. To be eligible for food stamps, your household needs to have a gross monthly income that is no more than 1.3 times the poverty line, and a net monthly income that is no more than the poverty line. For a family of four, that is a gross monthly income of $2,498 and a net monthly income of $1,921. Those that are eligible receive monthly benefits that vary based on how much need they have, and the average benefit last year was $133.41 a month per person. The people on this program are hardly living large. Additionally, the program does not cost that much. Last year, the program cost $74.6 billion, which was 0.47% of GDP. With that out of the way, we can get into why universal food stamps would be such a great idea. First, universal food stamps would make administration of the program so much simpler. Instead of having to detail all of your finances and long, complicated lists of deductions to get food stamps, the universal food stamp sign-up form would have only one question. Are you a person? If you check yes, you get food stamps. If you check no, you still get food stamps. Simpler administration saves money that is spent figuring out whether people are sufficiently poor, which frees it up for more productive uses. Second, when food stamps are universal, people will not lose benefits as they make more money, which means they will not have any incentive to avoid doing so. The way food stamps benefits are currently computed, every $1 increase in monthly income causes you to lose 30 cents in monthly food stamp benefits until you reach the cutoff point and lose benefits altogether. This means food stamps recipients face a marginal tax rate of 30%. That is not good for anyone, and we should just get rid of the means testing altogether, which a universal food stamp program would do. Third, a universal food stamp program is totally affordable. Using the most recent population estimates and a $200 a month per person benefit, we can calculate that the program would cost around $757 billion per year, or 4.8% of GDP. Of course, calling this a cost is a bit misleading. The money is really just being moved around. We would have to bump taxes to pay for it, but that tax revenue would get shot right back out for people to spend. The only direct losses would be the cost of administering the program. Of course, once we have gone this far, it is fair to wonder why exactly the Universal Food Stamp Program should give out food vouchers instead of cash. Even the current food stamp program faces these objections. Indeed, a universal cash program would probably be better. After all, since money is fungible, food stamps are already basically cash. Getting food stamps allows someone to replace some of the money they were spending on food with the food vouchers, and thereby free up that money for other expenditures. Giving out money directly would be no different, and it would eliminate the quote-unquote fraud in the system, where fraud just means people explicitly trading food stamp credits for money instead of using the fungibility of money to do it in the indirect way the program allows. The Universal Food Stamp Program, or Universal Cash Program, would seem to be a sure winner. It will make administration easier, eliminate fraud, avoid the means testing marginal tax rate problems, and give everyone assistance, not just the sufficiently poor. For a family of four, the program as described above would provide $9,600 of supplemental income each year, which would be a huge boon for their economic security and comfort, especially the poorest families. If you just tuned in, I've been reading a blog post by Matt Breunig called Just Give Everyone Food Stamps. I read this because I have been advocating basic income on this program for the last 6 or so months in different ways. Food stamps are already a partial basic income. Matt Breunig points out that food stamps are basically kind of already almost a cash program anyway, and what's useful about focusing on food stamps in the short term is that while we may not all be able to agree whether people have $2,000 a month of basic income needs, we can all agree that we have to eat, and making sure that everyone can eat is actually in everyone's interests, you know, unless you exploit people because they need to work to eat. And because food stamps are a program that already exists, we don't really have to come up with some cockamamie scheme. So if David Graeber's suggestion that we make a revolutionary demand for a debt jubilee or a dramatic reduction in the workweek sounds a bit more utopian than practical, food stamps for all is eminently practical and revolutionary. It calls our attention to the way that we need to reproduce ourselves as a society for the benefit of the many and not just the few. It also starts to draw our attention to the work that making sure everyone eats really is. In this regard, it's not that unlike the wages for housework movement that Selma James and Sylvia Federici advocate around. This is another example of that intersectionality that I brought up with Jeff Shantz. The intersection with the earth, with feminist struggle, with our bodies, with social reproduction, with the labor that actually makes society reproduce itself. But also with the struggle specific to the food system itself, like leveraging more local and regionally grown foods. It would be a crucial step towards what Shelley Koch in her book A Theory of Grocery Shopping advocates as putting provisioning over profits. A principle that is at the center of what Robert Dietz is arguing in his book, Enough is Enough. As far as I know, there isn't anything really like a food stamps for all movement. The closest thing I can think of is the basic income itself, which exists at the margins still because of how relatively utopian it is in its scope, which is both a strength and a weakness. Before being squeezed out of Congress by gerrymandering, Dennis Kucinich liked to talk about Medicare for all, so why can't we start talking about food stamps for all? Unlike a debt jubilee or even the demand for Medicare for all, food stamps for all would be impervious to any claims of a special interest. And if nothing else, perhaps, it would help us root out exploitation from our conceptions of what a just society and economy is. You're tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Joe Clement. Up next, Bill Resnick is going to bring us one last short commentary that I forgot to tell you about. I'm sorry, but it is about the Boston bombing and the reaction to it that we have seen across the United States, both positive and negative, and why we need to be on guard for the increased militarization of our society.
The Boston Massacre ended Thursday. One of the killers dead and the other captured and wounded. But Boston and other terrorist acts will not be forgotten. Indeed, the forces of law and order and militarism will not let it be forgotten. Just as they worked hard and successfully, with, of course, the help of sensation-seeking media, to burn 9/11 into the public psyche, this Boston massacre will also be continuously on the front pages, all TV stations, soon-to-be-released highly promoted Hollywood movies, their vivid pictures all reinforcing the right-wing story of national security. Wednesday and Thursday, as the drama unfolded, the whole country was watching, and watching an emotional orgy of right-wing ideas that included a fear and loathing of the killers and terrorists always lurking around us, always wanting to strike, hating us for our freedom and democracy and fellow feeling. The emotionalized drama also included elements of mourning, sympathy and grief for the victims and their families. And when the second killer was captured, it became a day of thanks and celebration. Thanks for the bravery and competence of the FBI and police who finally tracked down the killers. And in the end, there was relief and celebration, people embracing their neighbors and strangers too, crowds chanting, USA, USA, and through it all, the U.S. was portrayed as this greatest country on earth, its peoples united in our dedication to decency, democracy, and freedom. And it became a real feel-good story, we Americans again rising to the occasion, helping the wounded, healing the community, and also as a nation generous in helping others around the world. We are decent, blameless, a victim of madmen just bent on doing evil and exterminating us. This right-wing story has terrible impacts, first because it makes our fellow U.S. North Americans vulnerable to the appeals of the military-industrial surveillance complex, seeking to create their national security state, no expense too great to buy and deploy all of the forces and weaponry, and high-tech surveillance to save us, including drone strikes around the world, including developing weapons in space, torture around the world, networks of Big Brother cameras to watch everything, as well as stifling and forbidding dissent in this country. The Boston bombing and its coverage also served the rightist project because lavishing money and public resources on the military weaponry surveillance leviathan starves the rest of public services and public support to the poor and ordinary folks. Every dollar to the military and police is one less dollar for job creation, renewable energy, environmental restoration, medical care, medical research, education, workplace safety, and so many others, and makes life meaner and more difficult for most people. Finally, of course, this hyped fear of terrorism creates a bidding war among politicians about who is most devoted to national security and defending our country and spending resources to defend our homes and country. For me, it felt like the U.S. becoming Israel. Politicians and media contributing to create a frightened citizenry, bent on crushing those inhuman enemies and in the process creating more desperate and deracinated people in this nation and more enemies abroad, and all that while undermining their own country's civil liberties, environment, and economy. But this is not the whole story. If the rightists and military and forces of law and order greatly benefit from every terrorist act, they are not going to prevail without challenge. Because movements here in this country for peace and justice and civil liberties recognize the real threats to this country. They recognize that terror need be dealt with as a crime problem, that dealing with terrorism from abroad will only be solved as matters of social and economic justice and democratic, real democratic development that's environmentally sustainable, that creates decent income for all, that furthers real democracy in which people participate in the decisions that shape their lives. Even parts of the U.S. military and intelligence service and their periodic updated threat reports, threat assessments, these have come to recognize that the greatest threat to the well-being of the U.S., those who live here, is ecological calamity and the heightened inequality around the world. Indeed, most people in the U.S. are of several minds on terror and the need for protection. To be sure, they are frightened and worried and feel the need for protection, but they're also cynical about the military-industrial complex and fear these becoming too powerful, including the omnipresent surveillance. And they know that lasting security will not be gained by military might and by exterminating the enemy, that ultimately out-of-control spending on the military and weaponry and surveillance will destroy the things we value. If the Boston Massacre and its short-run exploitation by forces of the right now dominate the present moment, in the long run, the forces of sanity and social justice surely remain contenders in the battle for real national security. And we can all do our bit to work towards peace, justice, sustainable economics, authentic deep democracy, to ultimately check those powers hell-bent on creating a world that fosters more terrorism. This was Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Tell you why, there's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see. There's a better world to come and don't you see. When we'll all be union and we'll all be free, there's a better world a coming, don't you see? There's a better world a coming, and don't you know? There's a better world a coming.
Well, that is it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. Thank you to Jeff Shantz for talking with me about his book Green Syndicalism, Bill Resnick for his interview with Robert Dietz about his book Enough is Enough, Bill's commentary that you just heard also about the Boston Massacre, Matt Breunig for his insightful points about the affordability of giving food stamps for all, and Tom Becker for reading David Graeber's piece, The Practical Utopian's Guide for the Coming Collapse. If you want to listen to this part, to any part of this show, or the show in its entirety, go to the Old Mole website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in the next day or two.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, April 22nd, Earth Day 2013. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. Catherine Austin Fitz is my guest today on a special edition of Air Cascadia. Catherine is the managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services and publisher of the Solari Report, a website to which I commend listeners' attention. We're going to take a look at the question, who owns our finances and how can we take them back and end this escalating divide between the top 1% and the rest of us, the 99%, and how perhaps looking at financial markets as ecologies and applying principles from permaculture and various ways of managing and using our resources might provide solutions to some of the problems which have brought us so much grief recently. First, this though, from the National Weather Service. Today, sunny. We got a high around 65, and it's a bit breezy today, but it's going to get a little breezier, too, as a matter of fact. Tonight, clear skies with a low around 38, and north-northeast winds 5 to 10. Tomorrow, sunny, highs near 69. Light northeast winds becoming 10 to 15. It could gust up to 20 miles per hour. For tomorrow night again, it'll be a starry, starry night and low around 41, north winds 7 to 15, and it could gust up to 20 miles per hour. Starting off the week with the alternative forecast, the waxing gibbous fruit moon in Leo is 11 days old. The synodic and the biodynamicists have the same advice, and that is it's a good time to sow vegetables that have internal seed-bearing fruits. Indeed, because this is as a waxing moon, it's only going to wax for a few more days before it starts to diminish again. And if people are interested in experimenting with, or perhaps they've done it for some time, planting according to lunar cycles, now is a great time to get on board this April full moon coming up. Because that is indeed what lunar planning is all about. As far as the sidereal forecast, with the moon in Leo, they say what they often say: dry and barren, good time for garden maintenance. So that's it for both the conventional and the alternative forecasts. And we want to go straight to my guest this morning, Occupy Wall Street, if nothing else. Focus the left and the progressive community's attention on the world of finance and economics like nothing else. As I say, to paraphrase the old chestnut, you may not be interested in Wall Street, but Wall Street is interested in you. Americans have been reduced to consumers. Our only value to society is insofar as we're able to consume goods and services. This is the environment we're talking about, money as an ecology. The sooner we recognize this fact, the better we will be able to address the global warming situation that has created this climate collapse that we're currently bearing witness to. We are trying to reach Catherine Austin Fitz, and we will have her on the line in just a few moments. We may want to take a minor musical break while that interview is set up. Well, as we wait to see what is going to transpire, we're going to continue talking about this, perhaps applying some of the algorithms that are derived from climate problems to economic problems. In other words, viewing the way our current economy is structured. If we take some of those algorithms and map them onto the problems, then we do stand some remote chance of reclaiming our role as citizens rather than simply as long as we cling to being consumers only. I think that we aren't going to begin to approach addressing the problem of the discrepancy between the very, very wealthy and the rest of those who create the wealth. Catherine is on the line.